From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
CQDX, CQDX, CQDX. This is Havana calling.
Today, the co-founder of Radio Havana, in our continuing series on conversations in Cuba, Arnaldo Coro talks about his station and the CIA's. Also, he discusses his experience repulsing the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion led by his classmates. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Plea bargain talks were secretly reopened with lawyers for the Unabom defendant, this according to a magazine report that says the Justice Department may not want to risk a circus trial that could lead to appeals. Citing government sources, Newsweek reports in today's issue that Attorney General Janet Reno softened her resolve to seek the death penalty because the disarray at Theodore Kaczynski's trial could lead to numerous appeals. Last month, prosecutors reportedly turned down a conditional offer by Kaczynski to plead guilty in return for a life sentence and were prepared to open his trial on January 5th. However, Kaczynski told U.S. District Judge Garland Burrell that he wanted to fire his lawyers and represent himself at trial. Kaczynski later attempted suicide in his jail cell. The judge has put the trial on hold pending a psychiatric examination, which will be followed by a competency hearing scheduled for January 22nd. Terry Nichols has rejected an offer from federal prosecutors that would have allowed him to plead guilty in exchange for life in prison. This, according to Newsweek magazine. Nichols escaped the death penalty on federal murder charges when jurors last week deadlocked on the punishment. He still could face a death sentence if convicted on state murder charges in Oklahoma. Newsweek, citing unnamed sources, reported in the issue that hit newsstands today that Nichols rejected the federal deal last summer that would have allowed him to avoid a death sentence. The magazine said prosecutors also tried to persuade Oklahoma City District Attorney Bob Macy to agree to a plea arrangement on state charges. But Macy has said he will seek the death penalty against Nichols and co-conspirator Timothy McVeigh for 160 counts of murder. Army buddies McVeigh and Nichols were convicted separately in federal trials in Denver of the April 1995 bombing of Alfred P. Murrah Building. The explosion killed 168 people and injured more than 500 others. There's word of more bloodshed in Algeria. An armed gang has attacked and killed up to 120 people in a village outside Algiers in two separate attacks last night. One attack came as villagers were watching a movie. The other targeted worshippers in a mosque. Hospital sources say most of the victims were shot, stabbed, or hacked to death. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. At least 1,000 people have been killed in the past 2 weeks since the holy month of Ramadan began. There have been international calls for an investigation into recent massacres, but the government has rejected the idea. Back in this country, Paula Jones reportedly is now asking for more money to settle her sexual harassment case against President Clinton. The Washington Post says Jones wants $2 million and an apology. That's nearly three times more than her original asking price of $700,000. The newspaper reports settlement talks have resumed, but a deal does not appear imminent. Jones has accused Clinton of making improper advances toward her when he was governor of Arkansas and she was a state worker. Clinton denies the allegations. He's scheduled to give a deposition in the case on Saturday that Paula Jones is expected to attend. This news from Amarillo, Texas. There will be no red carpet treatment for Oprah Winfrey when she rolls her TV talk show into Amarillo this month. Winfrey's show will be in Amarillo for about 4 weeks while she defends herself against a defamation lawsuit brought by cattle ranchers. The president of the Amarillo Chamber of Commerce sent a memo to his staff saying Winfrey won't get a key to the city, flowers, or any other gesture. He said it's a show of support for the ranchers, but the Amarillo chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, says it's dismayed, shocked, and mystified by the memo. The lawsuit against Winfrey stems from a 1996 broadcast in which she said she was swearing off beef because of mad cow disease. The cattle ranchers say that she defamed beef, illegal in Texas. As senior officials from the United States and the International Monetary Fund launched an emergency effort to calm East Asia's economic turmoil, Hong Kong's stock market became the latest victim, falling sharply today. Rattled by rising interest rates, the failure of a major Hong Kong-based investment bank, and the sharp decline on Wall Street on Friday, the Hang Seng Index tumbled 8.7%, its lowest level since March 1995. Last week, the index dropped 16%. Share prices also fell in Singapore, Japan, Taiwan, Malaysia, and Australia. And Mexican rights groups and victims yesterday accused the army of beating 16 women and causing injury to several of their children in the strife-torn southern state of Chiapas. That's some of the news at this hour. Cuban President Fidel Castro, set to welcome Pope John Paul for a landmark visit to Cuba in 10 days' time, yesterday spurned the notion the pontiff would seek to change the Cuban leader's political views. Castro, speaking to reporters, also reiterated his warm respect for the Pope, whom he met 14 months ago, and said Havana did not want to politicize the visit. Castro added he had no indication the Pope was thinking of trying to persuade him to stop being a patriot, stop being a revolutionary, stop defending, quote, our country and our cause. The Cuban leader said it would be very odd if people thought that he, Castro, was going to try to get the Pope to change his views. Today we will continue with our ongoing series called Conversations in Cuba, based on my trip there over the holidays in preparation for the Pope's visit. Today we'll hear from Arnaldo Coro, Antich, better known to shortwave radio listeners around the world as Arnie Coro. Arnie Coro grew up with the Cuban Revolution, coming of age as Fidel Castro marched victoriously through the streets of Havana. He's a veteran of the Cuban effort to repulse the American-sponsored invasion at the Bay of Pigs in 1961. And at the same time, he co-founded Radio Havana, where he now works.
Why don't we start at the, not exactly the beginning, but close to it, the revolution in 1959. How old were you?
Well, I was 17. And, of course, I had lived in a bourgeois family, a petit bourgeois family, a middle class, not upper, not lower, but middle class. My father was a well-known medical doctor. My mother, a teacher at a bilingual school in which they taught English in the morning session and Spanish in the afternoon. So I learned English here in Cuba since I was a very little kid. And my family was part of the Cuban establishment of the 1940s and 50s. And that's where I grew up and where I learned about the so tremendous inequalities of the Cuban society of that time, the tremendous, horrible repression. For example, in my adolescence, I don't remember going to a party with teenagers without fear of being captured by the police and being disappeared and just killed because of the only fact of being a young person. So I had a very terrible adolescence. My teenage years were very difficult between 14 and 17 because at that time the country was going through very, very hard times and there was a tremendous struggle here in the island to try to get rid of that very tyrannical Batista regime that killed approximately no less than 20,000 Cubans in about 5 years or so.
And so what happened when the revolution began? How were you involved? How was your family involved?
Well, my father was a very altruistic person, and he was moved by the tremendous possibilities that he thought were going to open up for public health in the country, to do real public health. He had a background coming from a very, very modest, very poor family where several of his relatives, including his mother, which he never met, died of tuberculosis because of the very poor environment in which they lived. And his crusade was to get Cuba rid of tuberculosis, which, of course, required a national anti-tuberculosis health campaign, which he was able to implement between 1959 and 1972, effectively reducing the TB cases in the island to what the World Health Organization considers the theoretical minimum. Also, my dad was a sort of a person that could see the future very clearly. And among other things, he was one of the first physicians to understand a certain relation between Mycobacterium tuberculosis and the AIDS virus. One of his very last, he passed away in 1991, but just before passing away, he was working with a group of Cuban doctors on the relation between tuberculosis and AIDS. And in his days as a student, and you can see I admire my father very much because he was able to see the future, his dissertation for becoming a doctor was on the incompatibility of blood transfusions, which eventually led to the discovery of the Rh factor, which you know is so important to know before you do a blood transfusion. My father's thesis at the University of Paris at La Sorbonne was essentially the base from which the researchers started to work to find the actual Rh factor, the rhesus factor experiments that were done later with monkeys. So my father was very much involved because he saw the possibility of finding funds and equipment and above all the goodwill of the people coming from the mountains with the revolution to develop a national public health system. He saw it. And he also saw that this was a unique opportunity to get Cuba rid of this disease he hated so much because he had his elder brother and his mother died of tuberculosis and many other relatives in the family. So with this, all my family moved ahead and we removed ourselves from the middle class attitude to the Cuban Revolution at that time, and we all started to work for a better country, for a better future. It was a tremendous effort. Payment was not important. What was really important was what we were achieving. Now, I was working since 14 in the radio and television business. My father happened to be the doctor at one of the most important Cuban radio and television networks, his private medical practice of the 1940s and 50s. And I used to go to the station as a hobby. And it all started one day. I went to see the senior vice president at that station when I was 14, and I officially applied for a job. Now, he took this not as a joke, but very seriously. And he said, well, Arnie, Cuban laws give me permission to hire you as an apprentice. You can start. So this was my first job, which started in the summer when I was 14. But after the summer vacations were over, this very senior person in this, it's the equivalent of one of your American networks, you know, it was organized very similar to the American networks. As a matter of fact, it was sort of a mirror image of one of the American networks, NBC, for the fact. This guy said, well, you have done so well that I offer you to keep on working here on the radio. And so he provided with something which I have always been very thankful to this person. He provided for the possibility of rotating all positions at the radio and TV complex. So I learned how to work with the boom microphone at the TV studio and how to do the catwalks with the lights. And 6 months later, found me at the master control of the TV station. Everybody very shaky because a 15-year-old was doing the actual switching at the master control of that TV station where programs were worth a lot of money because this was commercial broadcasting. So this gave me a sort of general background of what radio and TV was. So when the revolution came into power, of course, I was very much involved with radio. And this station was nationalized in 1960. And then someone called me in late 1960 for what this person considered my amateur radio expertise could be very useful. Because I have also been an amateur radio since I was, well, about an 8-year-old kid.
You mean ham radio?
Yeah, ham radio operator. I started with a neighbor, and you know, this is a hobby. It's always with you. It travels along. Whatever you do, you are always a ham radio operator. My wife says that this is like an international brotherhood, and that we understand each other very effectively. And it crosses the most unbelievable barriers you can believe. Now, the fact was that this person came to me and said, you know, there's a project going on in which your expertise with amateur radio and this working knowledge you have with all broadcasting can be very useful. And I said, well, I'm 18 years old. What's my expertise? You know, he said, no, very important. So he took me to see a senior engineer, a very famous Cuban engineer, Carlos Estrada Castro, which was the chief engineer of Radio Progreso Network. And Estrada, which is, by the way, still alive, and the senior engineer of Cuban broadcasting, still consulting at age 81. When I have big problem at the station, I knock at his door. Well, Estrada told me, Corito, you know, like little Coro, Corito, this is something great. We're going to have an international shortwave station very soon. And I want you to be in that staff. So we started to work at the transmitter site in late 1960. And by February of 1961, we had on the air the first shortwave transmitter for what was then called the Onda Corta Experimental Cubana, or experimental Cuban experimental shortwave. And we ran that station as an experimental station until a day that I couldn't see because I wasn't there for some very interesting reason, which was May Day of 1961, when it officially went on the air as Radio Havana Cuba, its present name. Now, the reason I wasn't there is that by approximately March of 1961, the whole country went into a state of alert because there were rumors that Cuba was going to be invaded from abroad, which eventually happened in April of 1961.
So, by the United States.
Yes, this was not actually United States Armed Forces. This was a group of people, about 1,500 of them, which were organized in Florida, sent to Guatemala and to Nicaragua, and they were organized by the American Central Intelligence Agency. Very secretly, they were provided Air Force aircraft by the Air National Guard of Alabama. Those aircraft, by the way, were painted like the Cuban Air Force aircraft to confuse our ground troops. What happened was that they were so completely wiped out that by the time they were asking for help from the U.S. aircraft carriers that were near Cuba and so on, they were just all were prisoners. So obviously President John Kennedy decided not to intervene because it was a completely lost battle.
And, of course, you're talking about the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Of course, Bay of Pigs invasion, in which, by the way, radio played a very important role, too, because there was a radio station organized also by the CIA, by a CIA propaganda expert by the name of David Adlee Phillips, and he organized a radio station in disguise. It sounded like a commercial station, but it wasn't. And the station was located, the transmitter was installed by the Navy CBs in a very small island south of Cuba. A beam antenna, a directional antenna system, was installed there to cover Cuba with high power. And one of the very important American stations was practically knocked off the air every evening so that station could exist. So KSL from Salt Lake City, 1160, was very much affected by those broadcasts. But when they started to protest, they received a phone call, and this I got from the person that was the chief engineer at KSL many years later, an anecdote. KSL chief engineer said he received a call from Washington saying, hey, just shut up. This is government operation. This is no commercial station, although you hear Radio Swan and so on and so on. This is no commercial operation. This is a covert operation, and we trust you very much that you are going to keep silence. So he did for many years.
Arnaldo Caro, he is co-founder of Radio Havana. His family, though well off, threw their lot in with the Cuban Revolution and stayed in Cuba, unlike many wealthy families after the 1959 revolution. When we come back, he'll continue to talk about Radio Swan, Radio Havana, and about the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion. He fought against it. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our series, Conversations in Cuba, leading up to the Pope's visit next week to Cuba. I was sitting in Arnaldo Caro's home just about a week ago, talking to him about Radio Havana and about the Bay of Pigs invasion. He continues by talking about the Salt Lake City radio station that the U.S. government told to be quiet about the fact that its signal was being taken over by a secret CIA radio operation directed at Cuba called Radio Swan.
Actually, the station was still on the air, but this huge transmitter from Swan Island will wipe off his secondary service area completely at night. So KSL, instead of being heard 750 miles around Salt Lake City, Utah, was heard maybe 25 miles around his antenna only.
And what was heard in the rest of that area, the listening area?
Well, people heard a mixture of the Radio Swan anti-Cuban propaganda and KSL alternating up and down according to the propagation of the waves in the ionosphere.
Why was it called Radio Swan?
That was the name of the island, which was a territory in dispute between the U.S. and Honduras, which finally the U.S. gave up and gave back to Honduras. The reason Swan Island was chosen was that the territorial legality was very much in dispute at that time, and there was a weather station that was established there during the Second World War to give information to the flights going from the States to Panama, to the Panama Canal Zone, which was extremely important at that time, as you are aware. So that weather station was vital. Now, they built there a very short landing strip. The island is maybe a mile and a half long and half a mile wide or so. Now, they built this very small landing strip, and they brought the equipment from the U.S. with landing craft operated by the Navy Seabees. The Navy Seabees did the job, and the station was on the air since 1960 and until it just mysteriously disappeared after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, you know. What we call La Victoria, the Playa Girón, Playa Girón victory, and which is known in the States, you know, the other side of the story, the Bay of Pigs fiasco.
It's interesting because a new book just came out by Michael Ratner and Michael Smith called The FBI and Che, and in it, it's a lot of the documents that they got under the Freedom of Information Act about Cuba. And one of the documents, it says, heard that Che Guevara was wounded and is dying or is dead. And then there's a response to it on the document that says, and this is from the U.S. government, from the CIA, don't believe what you hear. That's Radio Swan.
Yeah, because it was their own propaganda station. So actually, they were biting their own tail, you know, because as you are aware, this station was part of the psychological warfare, the psycho warfare that was done to prepare the conditions for the landing of the invading forces. So I was involved with Radio Havana, Cuba, which, by the way, was no answer to anything, because Radio Havana, Cuba plans were started in December of 1959. It's very interesting because I have heard many stories saying that something was done in response of something. And that things were provided by the Russians, you know, the equipment for Radio Havana, Cuba. And when I hear that way of telling history, as a participant of history, I'm a live actor of that history, you know, that part of history, I start laughing, you know. Sometimes my wife she asks me, are you listening to a show on shortwave? And I said, yes. And why are you laughing? Oh, because they're telling the same old story again, full of lies. You know, Radio Havana was actually an idea of Che, which comes to the history of the tremendous success of Radio Rebelde in the mountains, providing information to the Cuban population that was denied by the Batista regime, which had established a very tight censorship of all the Cuban media. Radio Rebelde, with a very small amateur radio transmitter, was able to provide news to the whole island and also to foreign correspondents and foreign media. Now, there's one part which has never been told about this story, very important, is the fact that why Radio Rebelde was so effective. I tell it in one of my books about broadcasting in Cuba. The reason was that during 1958, there was the highest solar activity ever recorded. And as you know, short waves and the sunspots are related very much to each other. The higher the number of sunspots in general, the better radio shortwave propagation you have. So at that time, 1958, when Radio Rebelde went on the air, February 1958, the sunspot count was the highest ever recorded. And that meant that even with a very small radio transmitter, your signal will travel halfway around the world. And this was one of the reasons why Rebelde was so effective. Now, Che obviously drew from the experience of how important radio broadcasting was to the revolution. And
this was when he was in the Sierra Maestra Mountains.
Yes, and he was the founding father of Radio Rebelde was Che. Now, after the revolution came into power in 1959, Che continued to talk about the idea of developing shortwave, and by December of 1959, the Cuban delegation that was attending the Geneva Conference for International Telecommunications, the so-called World Administrative Radio Conference of 1959, received instructions from Havana to try to find shortwave transmitters for what would be Radio Havana, Cuba. Now, this was very interesting. They were in Switzerland, and they learned about the very famous Swiss manufacturer of electronic equipment known as Brown Boveri. So Engineer Estrada, which was my mentor, visited Brown Boveri as a courtesy call, and he just asked, you know, for the asking, and do you have any shortwave transmitters for sale? And the person that was there in charge said, you know, as a matter of fact, we have two very nice 100 kilowatt shortwave transmitters, which were originally bought by a Middle East country, and they have failed to pay for them. They paid for the initial, you know, those contracts. You have a down payment, and something is going on there in that country at this moment, and the present government is not paying. So you can have those two at a very reasonable price. So Estrada and the group of Cuban delegates at the conference wired back to Havana. Here we have two 100 kilowatt shortwave transmitters already built. You don't have to order them. You know, this you don't buy like you go to Kmart and give me one. You know, you have to order about a year in advance. But these were ready built. So these were the first two high-power transmitters of Radio Havana Cuba. So this is why I start laughing when I hear that Radio Havana Cuba was a reply to Radio Swan, which it never was, and that Radio Havana Cuba was using high-power Russian transmitters, which they never were. They were actually Swiss.
We're talking to Arnaldo Coro, who is a founder of Radio Havana and continues to work there today, more than 35 years after its founding. But before we move on to what you're doing today at Radio Havana and what exactly Radio Havana does, I wanted to go back to the Bay of Pigs invasion because you didn't talk about your own involvement.
Well, by March of 1961, every young Cuban that was part of the reserve forces was called into active duty. And to the regret of the group that was installing Radio Havana, I was asked to move to the active duty. They didn't want me to go because they wanted me to stay doing antenna work and doing the testing of the equipment and everything. But they said, no, leave the older persons to do that, and the young guys move to the active forces. We need communications people in the Army at this moment. So I joined a small communications unit in the Army and just did my active duty at the time that the country was under siege. And then finally, the day the Bay of Pigs invasion started, we were among the first to hear from that. Of course, we were in communication, so we were very much aware of what was going on. And my unit was asked to move into the battleground, which we did on the 19th, the invasion, I mean on the 18th. The invasion started on the 17th, 18th of April. Yes, because the invasion, we had first, the three airports in Cuba were bombed and strafing by B-26 aircraft, which were painted the same as Cuban Air Force. And those were flown by Cuban pilots trained by the CIA. And the planes were provided by the Alabama Air National Guard. And even some pilots of the Alabama National Guard were flying them. As a matter of fact, I saw a downed B-26 myself very near the Australia Sugar Mill, and the person that was flying that was an American. He was killed there, and I saw personally some of his documentation that said Alabama Air National Guard.
A Cuban-American?
No, this was an American-American, not a Cuban-American. This was a pilot which was obviously in the U.S. Air Force Reserve, and he was flying for the Alabama Air National Guard. Now, we went into the battleground, and when we arrived, the invading forces were retreating very fast. As a matter of fact, we had to run to catch up with the fast way they were running. And this put them into the swamps, into the Zapata swamps, which are the Cuba's biggest swamp. It's like the Everglades. It's almost exactly like the Florida Everglades. As a matter of fact, geological, I think it's the same kind of geological formation. These are huge swamps, and these people retreated into the swamps. Now, one of my most important jobs those days, after the 19th of April, when they finally surrendered, was to install a public address amplifier of the highest power possible with two big loudspeakers on a truck, and to try to go through those little roads in the swamps, telling them that the battle was over and that they should come in and turn themselves up because there was no possibility of surviving in the swamps, that they were going to be treated according to the Geneva War Convention, although I may add they didn't agree because this was not a conventional force, so they did not deserve this kind of nice treatment. Anyway, it was very funny because they were coming to the truck, you know. They have left all the military equipment away, and they had just run. They were coming to the truck, and the truck that was supposed to be only the public address system started to collect prisoners, you know. So I ended up operating this system, talking us on the microphone, and at the same time taking care of about 20 or 30 persons that were very much in distress. They had no water for several days, no food, and so on. And they were very shaky because they thought they were going to be sent to the firing squad. But I told them, no problem. You are consider yourself prisoners of war. Behave yourself. And it was very interesting because some of my schoolmates were among those prisoners, you know. So we had this shocking experience of having someone from your own high school there, you know, with ragged clothes and all in very bad shape and very hungry and very thirsty and so on, and say, hey, Arnie, you're here and so on, and what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm part of this outfit, you see. I'm the guy running this. And they couldn't believe, you know. But I said, no problem, you're not going to be killed. You're just going to be dealt as prisoners of war. I had someone, obviously, I was not naive, to check if they didn't have any handguns or something, which they had all been very careful to throw away in the swamps. Maybe one day when the archaeologists do something there, they will find many, many, many Colt 45 commando pistols, you know, from the Colt company, which were thrown away by these people in the swamps.
But weren't you shot?
Well, the last day they were still firing, they were using a very effective American weapon called a 4.2-inch mortar. That I learned later. And I was very at the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, because I was not a soldier in the strictest sense of the word. I was the guy with the telephone wires and that sort of stuff. So one of the people that knew more about fighting, an older military that had been in the mountains, said, hey, listen, don't go there with your telephone, a field telephone, you know. And I obviously did the wrong thing, and one of those 4.2-inch shells landed very near me, and some little pieces of the shell just hit me in my leg, which, very interesting, I didn't realize at the time. Then, many hours later, someone asks me when we were going at a place called Caleta Rosario, which is a small inlet in the coast. Someone asks me there, when things were all over, everything was clear, no more fighting, Arnie, were you transporting wounded soldiers? And I said, no. Are you sure? You have not lifted someone that was bleeding or something? And I said, no. And I said, look at your leg. And then I found out that I had that. Then I went into the water because the southern coast of Cuba is there and cleaned this with the salt water, which is very good. And then I did one of the most stupid things I have ever done. I removed one of the pieces of shrapnel by hand, and then I simply fainted, you know. Next thing, I find myself with about three doctors and lying down, and what do you do, and so on and so on. And I said, no, don't worry. Just put something there because I want to go and see the actual Playa Girón, you know, where the place that was the end of the invasion. And they said, okay, this is very small, no problem. We'll put something to fix your wound there. And I went very late. This was it was at night, maybe at 9 or 10 p.m. on the 19th of April. I came into the commanding post of Playa Girón, which was now part of the Cuban army. And from there on, I stayed in the area to do this, what I told you, to call with the public address system all those people. Imagine about 1,400 of them just moving around those swamps. They were very afraid of crabs, which won't let them sleep, huge crabs, and also of crocodiles, because there are many crocodiles in that swamp. They were very, very afraid. But as the story goes, the troops from Playa Girón came back to Havana for the May Day Parade, 1961, the 1st of May of 1961. So I was part of those victorious troops that went in that parade. And from there, I went walking to the station, again, to Radio Havana, with my complete military gear and everything, and I got, you know, this very nice welcome by everybody at the station and so on. And then they told me, you know, today we changed the name of the station. It's now Radio Havana Cuba and so on, as we planned, but you were not here. And I said, well, I wish I was, but I was at another place. So that's why I wasn't there the actual day that the station went on the air as officially as Radio Havana Cuba, May 1st of 1961. Will be 37 years next year.
You're listening to Arnaldo Coro Antich, better known to shortwave radio listeners to Radio Havana as Arnie Coro. We'll hear more from him after this break. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I was sitting in Arnaldo Coro's living room last week in Havana, Cuba, talking to him about his experiences since the revolution.
I wanted to get to your expertise. You are a professor at the University of Havana, have studied the U.S. media for many years, and have particularly looked at the ways the United States has tried to send propaganda into Cuba. Can you talk about those many efforts?
Well, that will last hours, not a single radio show. Essentially, things took a turn to the worst at two moments. One, in 1981, when the negotiations were going ahead for a regional broadcasting agreement, which was sponsored by the United Nations Specialized Agency, the International Telecommunications Union. And as a matter of fact, I was asked to travel to Washington as part of a Cuban delegation that was supposedly going to work out the draft for a broadcast agreement between the United States and Cuba. It was very interesting that while we were there at the same time in August of 1981, a leak came out, you know, one of those American press leaks, and someone wrote that President Reagan was considering installing a super high power broadcast station beaming to Cuba. Of course, that essentially that killed the possibilities of negotiating, you know. It all started in 1981, once again, and it led to the 20th of May of 1985, the start up of the so-called Radio Martí station, which they call the Voice of America service to Cuba, which of course has nothing to do with the Voice of America charter. If you read the 1976 VOA charter, which as approved by government, by the U.S. Congress, you will see that program content of that station has nothing to do about that. As a matter of fact, I have the perception that people at VOA are very upset with this Radio Martí being said that it forms part of the Voice of America.
Well, let's just talk about the name for a minute. Radio Martí, named after José Martí. Explain who he was.
Well, José Martí was the founding father of Cuba. He was the person that organized the revolutionary anti-colonial war that finally liberated Cuba from the Spanish colonial years, 400 years of Spanish colonial rule. As you may know, Cuba was the last Spanish colony to be liberated in 1898. And at that time, things went very wrong, and we ended up not with a free country, but with a U.S. intervention that lasted until 1902. So actually, our war of liberation against Spanish colonialism landed us not into an independent country, but into a U.S. intervention. You know, this is typical of the problems that we're talking about. Now, José Martí was essentially against the United States intervening in Cuban affairs and having to do anything with Cuban affairs. So this was a big mistake by the Americans to use that name. It was an insult to the Cubans, you know.
Even those Cubans who were against Castro?
My perception is that only a very few of what we know as the new annexionists, you know, there was a current in Cuba in the 19th century that proclaimed that Cuba be annexed to the United States, to be incorporated into the United States. And that's a very unpatriotic and very much hated political current. You know, everybody in Cuba that has the head above the shoulder will never accept that kind of political point of view of annexionism. But there are some new annexionists among the Cubans that left after 1959, and among those, maybe that would be a good idea, you know. But using that name is an insult to the average Cuban person's intelligence. So that's very important. Now, that station was organized in a way as to intervene in Cuban affairs, and the way it has been run, I don't know. The last time I heard about a scandal at that Radio Martí thing, I had lost my notes of which was the number so-and-so scandal. I think this was the number 27th or 28th. You know, every so often you hear about how they play with the budget, how they land contracts to friends, kickbacks, anything that you can expect.
Okay. This was the operation run by the late Jorge Mascanosa, well known as head of the Cuban American National Foundation.
Yes, but Mr. Mascanosa, as everybody knows, was a millionaire because he did some very suspicious businesses. You know, his business ethics were not very clear. As a matter of fact, even today we are seeing in Miami, one of his companies involved in yet another scandal with the city of Miami, getting contracts in the tens of millions of dollars for doing things they never did and that sort of thing. Now, this is sort of an export from the Batista days, you know. This was the way that the Batista government officials did their business. And many of the people that went to Miami in the early days of the revolution were Batista's henchmen and the people that owned the businesses that were sponsored by the Batista regime. So this doesn't surprise me at all. Now, the fact is that this radio station does not provide the information about the United States of America that a Cuban may want. You know, if I listen to a U.S. radio station, which is sponsored by the U.S. government, I would like to hear there the official point of view of the U.S. government, which I never hear on Radio Martí. It's very interesting. I have done classical content analysis on Radio Martí and the Voice of America Spanish program. You know, they have a Spanish program to Latin America, which has received tremendous cutbacks in the past 10 years. Although the money for Radio Martí has been there all the time, about $11 million every year of U.S. taxpayers' money, the fact is that the VOA real program to Latin America is always more and more difficult to find because it has less and less and less time on the air every year. Now, this is a paradox because content analysis that I have done on the Voice of America broadcasts and the Radio Martí broadcasts, when you show that at an academic meeting, people ask, are those two stations located in two different countries? This is the typical question I get from my fellow scholars. This Marti broadcast is, you know, run by a small group of persons that has practically no overseeing by the U.S. government. It's like a maverick operation. And as a matter of fact, Mascanosa, before passing away, was successful in sending essentially 90% of the Radio Marti operation down to Miami. Because one of the preconditions of the very difficult negotiations with the U.S. Congress for the 1983 Public Law 111, which gave way to the birth of the Radio Broadcasting to Cuba operation, Congress said, okay, we're going to give you the money, but the station has to be in Washington, obviously to keep some sort of control. But Mascanosa was successful during the Clinton administration, you know.
Not during Reagan, not during Bush.
No, but during Clinton. Because, you know, the Clinton administration, as I see it, has a very different policy. They just let things happen, you know. So he went there, he obtained some backing, some support, and practically 90% of the anti-Cuban broadcast Radio Marti thing went to Miami. Now, there are many reasons to do that. One of them is that it offers the Cuban right-wingers in Miami a unique opportunity to provide many kickbacks to their people that are going to vote for their would-be congressman or congresswoman. For example, if you hire a building in Miami because the federal government doesn't have a building to install a radio station, look and find who will be the person that the building will be hired from. If they have to hire a security service, you will find that the security service is much related to a group of right-wing Cubans. Who does the office cleaning? Another group of right-wing Cubans. Where are the supplies bought? You know, this thing gave Mascanosa and his group a unique opportunity of practically monopolizing power while running an operation which was paid by the U.S. government. You know, if they had raised money among their advocates and they run a station there, it couldn't have been better, except that they were running a radio station, and they are running it as practically a private operation, which is funded by something like $11 million. Now, and I'm not telling you the rest of the story of as an ultra-right-wing conservative American radio commentator likes to say. The rest of the story is that they were successful in establishing also a television station with the most unbelievable thing that you can see in the world. The only television station that broadcasts from a blimp at 10,000 feet above the ground, in violation of all international agreements on television broadcasting, under continuous notes from the International Telecommunications Unions to the American Federal Communications Commission, telling them every 6 months that the operation of the station at Cujo Key, Florida, from the blimp at 10,000 feet, is in violation of all international agreements of, you know, who is signatory? The U.S. government. They are in violation of an agreement that was signed by the U.S. and which was approved by the U.S. Senate as required by the U.S. law. So we have this very interesting thing. A message from Geneva, from a United Nations specialized agency to an agency of the U.S. government, reminding this agency that they are in violation of an agreement which the U.S. has signed and approved. And this is this unique TV station, which in my analysis is, I'm going to use a word I have heard sometimes in the States. I don't know if this is a nice word or not. It's a scam. You know, it's a way of getting about $10 or $11 or $12 million from the U.S. taxpayers to be more or less spread in Miami, because this TV operation was born in Miami. This didn't go through the supervision of being started in Washington. they started this TV Marti, and here we go again, you know, using the same name. The TV Marti thing was started in Miami. And as I see it, it's a way of getting away from U.S. taxpayers, $11, $12 million, so that they will be sort of handouts, you know, for some of their sympathizers. Because from the very inception of the TV Marti idea, the Cuban government called among all the Cuban engineering community to try to develop a way of stopping that TV signal from coming into Cuba. They requested help from everybody that knew anything about electronic engineering. And as a matter of fact, it was so successful that it's the effectiveness of this TV Marti signal from the blimp is practically zero. One day you may have unique, very special propagation of the signals, and perhaps some few people can see it. And also they run into a big problem because they were in violation of this agreement. They had to broadcast at a time that the Cuban station on that frequency was not in use. Now, this ended up with the following operation. A TV station that operates from about 3 o'clock in the morning to about 6 o'clock in the morning. When, according to statistics provided by the Cuban social researchers, 99.1% of the Cuban population is asleep.
Arnie Coro, actually Arnaldo Coro Antich, and yes, if you listened to Democracy Now! Last week, we interviewed his mother, Rosa Antich, also a professor at the University of Havana. Arnaldo Coro, better known as Arnie Coro, on Radio Havana. After the interview at his home in Havana last week, we went over to the radio station where he produced and broadcast his show.
CQDX, CQDX, CQDX. This is Havana calling. CQDX, CQDX, CQDX. This is Radio Havana calling all shortwave listeners and radio amateurs. Margarita Delgado, my sound engineer and producer, and we have visitors today here at the recording session 2 from Pacifica Radio in the USA. See you next year on shortwave, of course. Happy 1998. And that's all for today. This is Arnie Coro, Radio Amateur CO2KK, your host here at Radio Havana's DXS Unlimited, saying 73 and very good DX.
And Arnie Coro's email address is arnie@radiohc.org. That's arnie@radiohc.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with Sammy Lee Webster-Woog, Errol Maitland, our engineer, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.